they could ever acquire. But instead of being a boon, it had turned into a bane for further growth. Now, our approach is going to have to be a little bit more surface level, because we're going to be covering chapters 8, 9, and 10. But I felt like in order to do this justice, we needed to take these chapters all together. Ryan, I think I've got both this one on and this one on. Is it interfering with the listening pieces back there? What's that now? All right, maybe turn me down a little bit. My levels of obnoxiousness are being amplified. Let's go ahead and turn into chapter 8. I want us to begin by reading the first 8 verses together. Starting in verse 1, Paul writes to the brethren there, "Now concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge makes arrogant, but love edifies. If anyone supposes that he knows anything, he has not yet known as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by him. Therefore, concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that there is no such thing as an idol in the world, and that there is no God but one. But even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom we are all things, and we exist for him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we exist through him. However, not all men have this knowledge, but some, being accustomed to the idol until now, eat food as if it were sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But food will not commend us to God. We are neither the worse if we do eat, nor the better if we do not." Now let me pause there for a moment. As we begin looking at this chapter, at the outset, we need to understand the deeper problem being addressed by the Apostle Paul. Now, if one were to say that this section is dedicated to meat sacrificed to idols, then you would not be wrong, because after all, those are the very first words that Paul begins in this chapter. However, the core conflict that's being addressed is not the eating of meats. And I want you to understand that I'm not trying to be clever. But in order to understand this section, we need to see it broadly as dealing with love, consideration, and the Spirit of Christ as being the test of true knowledge. And so we talk about knowledge. What is knowledge if it is not simply a means to an end? Knowledge is something that we acquire for the purpose of guiding and directing our actions. Now, if we have a knowledge of God, and if we have a knowledge of who God is, then what ought to be our proper reaction? Well, first of all, knowing things about God is going to cause us to behave and conduct ourselves toward Him in certain ways. But then secondary to that, a knowledge of God is going to affect how we interact with other people. And then finally, it's going to affect the way that we conduct ourselves personally, guided by those truths. But Paul is dealing with the question of asking, where does it lead us when our knowledge is stripped of love and consideration as its guide? Does it not lose its proper direction? Verse 4 of our text applies that specific question to those things that are sacrificed to idols. Now, speaking of the brethren in Corinth, as those who had left idolatry, they were now in possession of certain knowledge. They knew that Jehovah or Yahweh was the one true God. But Paul poses, for the sake of argument, let's say that there are other gods, whatever those may be, in heaven or on earth, as he puts it. Even if, supposing there were other gods, then Yahweh would still stand above them, And he would still stand alone as being the only one worthy of worship. And so even if there are other spiritual entities that are trying to claim lordship, it is for God the Father that we exist, and it is through God the Son that we are even capable of having existence. And so what should we do with that knowledge? That even if there are these other spiritual entities, we don't have allegiance, we don't have association with them, we only have association and allegiance with God. Would it not lead us to clinging to the one through whom we have our very existence and a complete repudiation of everything else? I think that's what Paul is stating would be the obvious answer. But those who had knowledge, their so-called knowledge, had led them to continue to dabble in things associated with the worship of idols. And so Paul continues in verse 9. But take care that this liberty of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if someone sees you, who have knowledge, dining in an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if he is weak, be strengthened to eat things sacrificed to idols? For through your knowledge, he who is weak is ruined, the brother for whose sake Christ died. And so, by sinning against the brethren and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food causes my brother to stumble, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause my brother to stumble. So Paul continues this and says that other brethren, while worshiping God alone, are still mindful of the possibility of there being other gods, other spiritual entities, and eating meat that had been associated with the worship of those idols was a cause of stumbling for the conscience of these Christians. Now, as Paul will go on to say here, as well as in chapter 10, it is not the eating of meat in and of itself that is the problem, but through their supposed knowledge, some had taken it a step further, and they were even going into the temple of these idols and engaging in feasts. Here they were not only eating meat that they knew full well had been sacrificed to idols, but now they were participants. What effect had this taken on those who were already struggling with their consciences? It emboldened them even more to violate their own conscience to a further degree. I think we need to note in this section that while Paul speaks of those who have the issue of conscience as being weak, Paul is not here describing a strong and weak dichotomy that he sets up in a place like Romans chapter 15. The brethren who were going into idols' temples and engaging in these feasts were not to be described as strong. Nor should we imagine that they were really knowledgeable. I believe we can see in the text that Paul is speaking somewhat accommodatively. What they had was an arrogant perversion of knowledge that was leading to ruin instead of edification. And so Paul says that their knowledge, or what they thought was knowledge, had in fact led them into a state of sin, where they were sinning against their brethren and they were sinning against Christ. What they were not doing was thinking of their brethren whatsoever, which causes us to wrestle with the question of who do we think of first? Is it not usually ourselves? I think that almost always the answer is going to be it is self, unless, of course, we are dealing with a problem, and then our general tendency is to first think of others as either being the cause or the responsible party. But if we're thinking about desire and fulfillment and gaining and attaining, then we are thinking of ourselves first. What do I want? Everything has a tendency to begin with me. But Paul draws our attention here in this chapter that real knowledge, if it can be defined as such, real knowledge starts with God. A knowledge of who he is and how that should cause us to behave before Him. Then that knowledge is going to extend to others. How do I interact with, how do I treat those who are made in His image? What are my responsibilities toward them? Then it ends with me. Anything that seeks to exclude other people or God, or anything that rearranges that order and tries to put me before others and tries to put me before God, cannot truly be called knowledge. But I think that Paul also raises a question that we have to deal with, or a notion to consider. And that is how easily we sometimes dismiss our brethren. That's what's happening in the church at Corinth. When it comes to our actions and the way that they may affect other people, or the way that they may exclude or include other people, it is sadly incredibly easy for us to completely eliminate others as a factor. To imagine that we don't owe others any consideration whatsoever, or that the consideration which we do owe one another is of an extremely insignificant amount. And so Paul uses himself as an example in the following chapter. In chapter 9, beginning in verse 3, Paul says, "My defense to those who examine me is this. Do we not have a right to eat and drink? Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or do only Barnabas and I not have a right to refrain from working? Who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Or who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? I am not speaking these things according to human judgment, am I? Or does not the law also say these things? For it is written in the law of Moses, 'You shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing.' God is not concerned about oxen, is he? Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? Yes, for our sake it was written, because the plowman ought to plow in hope, and the thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. If we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? If others share the right over you, do we not more? Nevertheless, we did not use this right, but we endure all things so that we will cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ." Again, we have to maintain an awareness of the surrounding context. The issue at hand is once again not merely the financial support of those who minister in the gospel. Paul takes the time to show that financial support of men like himself or their families, if they chose to bring them along, that those things are God approved and even expected. But Paul's sole purpose in establishing the fact that he had the right to be paid is so that he could choose to not exercise that right. His whole purpose in showing that he had the right to receive support was so that it would make an impact on them when he refused to take their support. Now, in their specific situation, Paul chose to do so in order that it would be clear that his preaching had been done from love and not out of ulterior motives. But the immediate point that Paul is making is one of contrast. Over here, you have these supposedly enlightened, these supposedly knowledgeable brethren, and they are demanding that they get to exercise the rights that they have. They had no concern for, and they were incapable of seeing all of the destruction that they were leaving in their wake. On the other hand, you have Paul, who really does have knowledge. The apostle who has genuine, true knowledge was fully entitled to their support, but chose to relinquish his rights so that it would help people grow spiritually. I think it becomes clear in the second half of the chapter that this attitude was not merely limited to just one area. In verse 19, he writes, "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all so that I may win more. To the Jews, I became as a Jew so that I might win Jews. To those who were under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without the law, as without the law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, so that I might win those who are without law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that I may by all means save some. I think it would have been impressive if Paul had just made this one physical sacrifice. But what if Paul had said, this is where I draw the line. This is it and no further. I'm willing to work with my hands, but that's all you folks deserve. But Paul was willing to give of every aspect of himself for the benefit of others. He was willing to give of himself physically, mentally, and emotionally. Now, I don't think that these verses should leave us with the impression at all that Paul was somehow putting on a false face everywhere he went, or that he was lacking in authenticity. But rather, what Paul describes is someone whose identity and personhood is buried so deeply in the person of Jesus Christ that there is no sense of self that they have to demand to hold on to. Paul could freely relinquish all of his rights that he was entitled to, because to Paul, the most important thing was being a faithful Christian, not whether or not he got what was his, and certainly not whether or not he got what was his at the expense of others. And so if he had to either engage in certain matters or abstain from certain matters so that doors could be opened for the gospel, then he saw that as being a very small sacrifice to make. I think verses 22 and 23 highlight the full degree to which Paul gave of himself, and in doing so, set the standard for which we should strive to live by. Verses 24 through 27 give us that famous text about running in such a way that we win, and saying in verse 27, I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. Again, I think we can make general applications from these verses, but we should also ask ourselves how it applies in the immediate context. What is Paul speaking about? He's speaking about sacrificing things that you are owed or entitled to or have the right to for the betterment of others. Are you disciplining yourself in such a way as to benefit your brethren and not be disqualified by causing others to stumble in the race that they have to run? And if you are not being mindful of others and considerate of others, then what good is your discipline doing you? Well, Paul brings it back around and gives another practical example in chapter 10. In chapter 10, beginning in verse 1, he says, for I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now, these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Now, again, we need to understand that Paul has not suddenly and drastically changed the topic of conversation. But what purpose does it for us to now draw our attention to looking at Israel in the wilderness? Well, there are two points that he makes about Israel. First is the advantage that they had, and second is the result that it got them. The advantage that they had was the presence and the provision of God. And even though they were not fully aware of the fact, Paul says that they also had the presence of Christ in their midst as well. But although they walked in the very presence of God, what was the result? Well, verse 7 says that they fell into idolatry, and as the verses continue, they fell into every behavior that comes along with idolatry. There are parallels that are being made to the situation of Corinth from chapter 8. Both Corinth and Israel had knowledge that the Lord, Yahweh, was the one true God. Corinth knew that God was above all idols. Israel knew that God was above all of the gods of the Egyptians. But both of them had that knowledge and divorced it from its proper use. And where did it get them? Israel, although they knew that God was the one true God, they walked in His very presence, they fell into idolatry. Corinth, you're not any better than they were. As he asks at the end of chapter, you are not stronger and wiser than God. Your knowledge has led you to the same place. Simply knowing does not prevent error. Having knowledge on an academic level does nothing. It must be properly applied. I suppose that some might have accused Paul of maybe mixing his metaphors. And so he responds in verse 14 and explains himself further. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to wise men. You judge what I say. Is not the cup of blessing which we bless a sharing in the blood of Christ? Is not the bread which we break a sharing in the body of Christ? Since there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Look at the nation Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices sharers in the altar? What do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, but I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons or not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers in demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? We are not stronger than He, are we? Again, someone might look at this and say, Paul, this isn't the same thing at all. Look, we know that these idols are nothing. We know that God is the true God. We're just going in. We're participating in the feast. It's no big deal. We don't really believe all this stuff. Well, Paul says, when you partake of the cup and the bread, what are you doing? Well, we're sharing a meal with the Lord. All right, when Israel partook of the sacrifices of the altar, what were they doing? Well, they were sharing a meal with God. Okay, so if you partake of a meal at the altar of an idol, what are you doing? Well, we're sharing... Oh, wait a second, Paul. You're not going to get me. No, it's the same thing. And Paul is trying to get them to see that in no uncertain terms, they were not to go into the temples of these idols, regardless of how much they thought that they knew. Their knowledge, or what they thought was knowledge, had led them to the wrong conclusion. They were thoughtless of others, they were thoughtless of themselves, and ultimately they had placed themselves in fellowship with idolatry. Which again, I think, brings us to a very salient point that we need to ruminate on, and that is how often are we guilty of ignoring the pleas and the warnings of others because we simply know better? Someone tries to communicate to us that the path in which we are headed on is going to be a stumbling block to them, and yet we know that it is harmless. We know that it is not going to affect us spiritually. We know that we can engage in these things. We can give of ourselves in these ways. We can commit ourselves to all of this time, and it will not affect us. We know better than everyone who tries to tell us otherwise. Again, in the same way that knowledge can pervert us to be so easily capable of being inconsiderate of others, a fascination and a falling in love with our own knowledge can shut out all wisdom that tries to reason with us. And so Paul applies these things in verse 23. He brings it back to their mantra from chapter 6. All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own good, but that of his neighbor. Eat anything that is sold in the meat market without asking questions for conscience sake, for the earth is the Lord's and all it contains. If one of the unbelievers invites you and you want to go, eat anything that is set before you without asking questions for conscience sake. But if anyone says to you, this is meat sacrificed to idols, do not eat it for the sake of one who informed you and for the conscience sake. Let's pause there for a moment. Again, returning to this idea that they had in chapter 6, well, everything's lawful. Paul says, okay, you say that you have the right to do however you please, then discipline yourself and train your will so that what you take pleasure in is seeking the good of others. Paul was not asking them to make unreasonable sacrifices or restrictions. He wasn't placing a weighty prohibition on them. It was fairly simple as he outlines it here. Eat with a clean conscience, but if you know something is associated with idols, stay away from it. That's a pretty small sacrifice to make. Our knowledge often overcomplicates matters. Doing the right thing is sometimes pretty simple. But self-willed people often react to simple instructions as though they are overly burdensome. The situation that Paul is dealing with, again, the brethren at Corinth had become knowledgeable. But instead of reacting to that knowledge in a way that showed humility and love and service, they had become arrogant. Paul, who had real knowledge, set an example of using your knowledge to serve others instead of making demands on what you were entitled to. He points to Israel as an example of how having knowledge is no guarantee against going astray if you don't have the proper reaction to what you know. But he tells us in chapter 10 and verse 13 that God has preserved their example for our learning and provides us with a way of escape. We have the ability to discipline ourselves so that our knowledge is put to use for the benefit of others. Ask for your attention for just a few more moments as we can think about taking these things with us in the week ahead. Knowledge, if it is real knowledge, must be put to use to serve others. Knowledge is one of those things that if it is not used, if it is just hoarded, then eventually it's going to turn. It's going to become poison. It's like taking a great stockpile of food, keeping it for yourself, saying, look at all that I have, look at all the goods that I've accumulated, and not sharing it with anyone else. Eventually, what's going to happen to it? It's going to turn. It's going to be moldy. It's of no value. It'll be poison if you try and imbibe it. And knowledge, if it is just kept internally, and it is not put to use to serve other people, it has the same effect. It poisons you. It turns you arrogant as it slowly drives love out of your mind. Knowledge has to lead us to serve others. That is the only proper reaction to a knowledge of who God is. And if the things that we claim to know about God, if the knowledge that we say that we have is not driving us to serve other people, then it's not real knowledge. And finally, knowledge has to be tempered. It has to be checked by a standard outside of ourselves, outside of my own reasoning. It is so easy to get carried away by knowledge. And what I mean by that is to either convince myself that I know better than others, I know more than others, and I have the right path ahead and I'm going to blaze it. Or I get caught up in someone else who says, I know more than others. I know more than the elders. I know more than the deacons and the brethren. I know more than the preacher. I know the way ahead. And they can be real convincing. And they can pull you right along with all of what they supposedly call is knowledge. But we have to ask ourselves of those things that we think make us knowledgeable. Is your knowledge causing you to think more of yourself? Well, as Bill started our service a moment ago in Galatians chapter 6, people who generally think they know something about something generally don't. Is your knowledge causing you to think less of others? Are you looking at your brethren in a pejorative way? Are you getting embittered against them? Do you think of them as being weak-willed and weak-minded? Beware of anything that begins with the sentiment, those folks just don't know as much. Or those folks just aren't as strong as we are. Because those are the predecessors to going through and stomping down bruised reeds and snuffing out flax. If knowledge is devoid of love and consideration of others, then it is not knowledge. Again, I think what Paul is speaking of is using accommodative language. Real knowledge, knowledge that is paired with love, knowledge that seeks to gain understanding, does nothing but good in the body of Christ when we use it properly. But knowledge that speaks of in these texts, this knowledge makes arrogant and causes us to sin against Christ and causes us to sin against each other. So thankful that God has equipped us, though, with examples so that we do not make those mistakes and has equipped us with a way of escape for whatever we encounter. I appreciate your attention this morning, and as we draw to a close, and we get ready to extend the invitation, there may be some this morning who have not yet responded to the gospel. That knowledge is the most precious, the most sacred thing that you can have. The knowledge that your sins are washed away and forgiven. You have that opportunity this morning. And maybe there are some who have already made that decision. You find yourself struggling with some of the things we've spoken about today or things that only you know of. If we can help you, if we can encourage you in any way, now is an opportunity dedicated to you. You can respond while we stand and sing.